Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
And I'm the man who wasn't there.
And we're... Wow, you threw me off. Today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 10, entitled Palindrome. Everybody knows what a palindrome is, right?
It's a man, a plan, a canal, Panama.
It's Mom.
It's Radar.
It's
Taco Cat.
Taco Cat, I've never heard that one. That's a good one. It's a word that is the same read forwards as it is backwards.
Yeah. So I read Sippinwall's review, and I thought that his opening analogy of the palindrome was pretty fucking forced.
What did he use it as?
He said, like, essentially, well, you know, no one in this season... He took it from it. I'm using my stupid guy voice. I need to back the fuck up. I'm talking about Alan Sepinwall.
Alan Sepinwall.
Let me take it down a couple notches.
No, come on.
Let me take it down a couple notches. He started off by saying that all the character he came at from a character analysis standpoint for the first thing.
Okay.
And then he said none of the characters are really a palindrome because everyone is transformed by this process either into dead matter. Or to be like opposite of where they started the season, except for Lou. Lou's always been this decent, strong man, and he starts the season that way, he ends the season that way, and he continues through season one that way. And I just thought that was kind of, I don't know, I felt like that was a pretty forced use of the palindrome metaphor.
I think if you expand it a little bit more to Lou's family. Remains surprisingly untouched by this season, right? I mean, the stuff that we assume, the stuff with the language that Hank was doing, we assume happened before. Well, we know happened before this. His wife didn't die during this season. Mm-hmm. So, like, none of them die. None of, like, Betsy goes back to not being on the drugs and still having cancer. Like, all of this stuff is kind of... I don't know. I don't know how to reconcile this idea of a palindrome with... It's not that nothing has changed in a word,
well, see,
right?
Here's my take on it. This change stuff, that's not included in the word palindrome.
I know.
It literally means the same forward as backwards. And I was trying to apply this. Does this literally hold true for this season? And I didn't think so, but what if we look at both seasons as a whole? Mm-hmm. You know, in chronological order, this is essentially, you could argue, the story of how Hanzi turns into Moses Tripoli, who is the top boss of, Fargo, Minnesota, and then how he eventually is brought down by Lorne Malvo, who is at the same time ascendant.
Uh-huh.
So, like, those two threads of the peaking and the falls of these crime bosses and these henchmen that become kingmakers, I guess that's kind of interesting. Like, if you literally took these things in either chronological or reverse chronological order, they're essentially the same theme and beats and stories.
Yeah, the kernel of the idea is there, and I think that's all I really needed.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of thinking about this season in light of a couple of things.
Well, first of all, we took a lot of flack for the last podcast. Apparently.
As I expected,
I don't think it's fair to call it a minority opinion to say that you didn't like the UFO, but certainly was an unpopular one.
Sure.
When I said polarizing, and I think actually you're the one who said polarizing, that's a very good choice of words because there was a big gulf between the people who liked the UFO and the people that didn't like the UFO, and there was really no way to, like, I see where I missed the bridge. There wasn't any real way to bridge those opinions.
No.
They were very strong, polarly opposite opinions.
And I think there's room for you to understand what Noah Hawley is trying to do and still not enjoy it, still not like it.
Sure.
And I think that's where I fall, because I've thought a lot about, you know, the aliens and kind of this level of absurdity that's gone on throughout the season, and how those things fit together and kind of, you know, the Camus' idea of the myth of Sisyphus. And that has been today. Just today, I finally found out what Myth of Sisyphus is actually about. Whenever anyone talks about the Myth of Sisyphus, they talk about the guy pushing the stone up the hill, right?
Uh-huh.
Over and over, and how dumb it is, and how futile and silly the whole thing is.
Uh-huh.
No one ever mentions the final line of that story, which is, one must imagine Sisyphus happy. Yeah. Because Sisyphus has come to embrace the absurdity of all of it, and is now content with it, and sees this as his mission. He has redefined his reality to have a mission.
Right. It's like most people leave Sisyphus in kind of like, I guess, how people imagine. Like, if you lose your religion, you just sit here and suddenly you're in a universe that has no meaning.
They imagine him in hell.
Right. Frankly. But at the end of that, like, most people eventually progress to the point of realization of, oh, well, if life has no meaning, then we are free to define whatever meaning we want and find our happiness. And that's actually kind of a liberating, exciting thing.
And that has been my reflexive reaction to Noreen this entire season.
Yeah.
Where she's always expecting, oh, but Camus is this, Camus is this. And Camus doesn't actually say what Noreen thinks he's saying.
Well, to be fair, she's not finished the book.
Really? She never finished it?
No, I mean, she was reading Myth of Sisyphus in this episode, and she's like, what, three quarters of the way through?
All right.
So, you know, I think you can be forgiven by, you know, for...
Absolutely.
She's still down in purgatory, in limbo. She hasn't been let out. She needs a black man to blow his head off and feed her poison so she can understand and be happy.
Yeah, I think that recontextualizes a lot of this season for me.
Uh-huh.
Whereas they're not trying to say, hey, look at this absurdity, what's the point?
Uh-huh.
They're trying to say, hey, take your own point away from this. Make your own conclusion from it. And I think that's more interesting.
Certainly.
I still don't like the alien thing.
I don't think
thing.
It makes it a more successful form of entertainment, but you but know, I can that's at least the thing. Yeah, and going forward with Fargo, I don't. Again, I'm trying to figure out how I can avoid this happening again because I think that a lot of this is expectation.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's you know, while it's true that there are many, many, many tones in Coen Brothers movies, it's very rare that they would put like a Raising Arizona in the middle of a Null Country for old men.
Sure.
Now, you can have some grim humor, but you can't get quite as slapstick as, you know, you got to kind of decide which mm-hmm. movie you're going to make. And I think that's my least favorite movie of theirs probably is Burn After Reading. And I think that's my big problem is they did try to go for like broad comedic overtones, but also a little existential angst and also some senseless violence. And it was, you know, to me, it wasn't appealing at all. But I also my big takeaway. So I finished watching this, and I'm going through our forums. I'm reading reviews, and the TV's on in the background because my DVR shut off. And what was playing but the Family Guy Star Wars special?
Okay,
and that is essentially every 5 seconds you get a sick Lucas reference with mm-hmm. you know a modern sarcastic take to it. And some people fucking love Family Guy, and they fucking and they're Star Wars fans that think that Family Guy Star Wars specials they're like the best things in sliced bread. And as I was watching, I'm like, I don't know, man, this is dumb. Like at some point,
it's not saying anything.
At some point, it's just you've taken a bunch of Star Wars flashcards shuffled together and dealt them off the top deck. It's kind of like Cards Against Humanity played in random mode.
Yeah.
Which you
it's
know,
like it's, quoting going around quoting Monty Python's Holy Grail all the time.
Yeah,
what are you trying to say?
Yeah, so
when
that's
you
not
say
that's,
knee.
That's not like a really unique concept. I mean, the South Park guys like 7 years ago made fun of the Family Guy writers for this essential thing.
Yeah, sure.
I'm kind of worried that Noah Hawley is becoming like the Family Guy of drama because I floated this idea in the forums, and surprise, surprise, the people that really liked him doing this did. You know, didn't care for the comparison. And I'm not saying the Fargo is Family Guy. I was saying that eventually if you try to cram as many word-for-word, shot-for-shot sequences from the Coen Brothers films into this series that it becomes self-referential for self-referential's sake, and it really starts distracting me from the main story. Like, at some point, I mean, it's like, okay, sometimes that's cool. Like, you take Mamma Mia. It's a musical entirely made of ABBA's catalog, and they tell somehow a narrative plot by stitching all these things with some very few interstitial scenes to kind of get the progression going.
Mm-hmm.
But it's entertaining and it's fun, and I think there's a little bit of cleverness to that. Like, how many direct situations can we lift from all these unrelated movies and still use it in a plot that moves forward?
Yeah. I get what you're saying.
Yeah, it's a very it's a transformative kind of mashup culture thing to do, but Sometimes I think that he needs to err on the side of telling the story rather than going for the sick reference.
Yeah, I mean that. I don't know. I guess that didn't bother me a ton, except where it started to interfere with the plot. I mean, like, if you throw in a line from Fargo or a line from The Big Lebowski or a nod to it, I don't really have a problem with it. It's where it's like
when you force it.
Yeah, I mean, it's clashing tone too. You kind of hit it on the head where you say, you know, the Fargo or the Coen brothers do a lot of different types of movies,
yeah,
and they all have different themes and tones. But trying to force them all into one felt wrong to me. Like this, the stuff with the aliens coming out of nowhere and just like this is not the kind of absurdity that I expect from Fargo,
right?
Like Fargo was always grounded in a sense of reality,
yeah.
Whereas I get some of the other Coen Brothers stuff is not.
Sure.
Like, I don't know how you reconcile the stuff that happens in Barton Fink toward the end of that with reality.
Sure.
But Fargo's not like that for me. And yeah. So this show being Fargo, named Fargo, and doing all these other things is kind of a problem for me. Because that's subverting my expectations in a way that doesn't feel satisfying to me.
Yeah.
It's almost like, if you name it this thing, I want it to reflect kind of what that thing is.
Yeah. But it's also, it's like, you know, I know there's like a reason people can disagree, but I feel like it's a matter of degrees, because no one's suggesting that you could take like Tom Hanks's character from The Lady Killers and take that character and make them, and that was Dodd Gerhardt.
Uh-huh.
Everybody'd be like, what the fuck? Yeah. So it's not that we don't get the references, and it's not that the references are not always used cleverly. It's just that, like, we can all agree that there are some references that just wouldn't work. We're just kind of arguing over matters of degrees. Like,
sure.
How much it didn't work for me, how much it did work for you, that kind of thing.
And the big thing with the aliens.
Yeah.
Are you going to read a ton of feedback about that? Do you
have
a bunch?
I took a few.
Because I know we got a lot.
I took a few defenses that I thought were unique and original.
Okay, I mean, we might rehash some of this, but I think the thing there is, you know, it's an absurdity that's on a level I never saw in Fargo, and then you put that on top of, like, the deus ex machina of saving the main character, and
yeah.
And just the idea, like, I get it, it's 1979, people were concerned about aliens,
mm-hmm.
Still are, to a certain degree, like, it didn't mesh with, I guess, where I wanted this thing to go.
Yeah, and I also think that's not a great defense, the fact that this really happened defense. Like, yes, in this big world, lots of weird things happen, and also I don't believe in UFO encounters. So the fact that there are some people out there that had something unexplained that they want to say is a UFO, and, like, you know, our first reaction to the Minnesota cop is like, oh, somebody had a few too many drinks at the Waffle Hut. Hit some black ice, lost control of their squad car, and suddenly, aliens.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I don't think it's a great defense to be like, well, if this has actually happened, or this was actually possible. And it's also weird, that's another thing, that at a certain point, all these anecdotes that everyone's like, ooh, what great writing this is, and it's so fun to see, you know, Patrick Wilson saying it. The fact that they're just really reciting anecdotes from Wikipedia is kind of takes away from, I think, the charm of it too. Like, it's fine. Like, maybe once or twice a season you can do that, but when it happens like 10 times a season, it starts feeling, and I get it. There is this concept of they're doing this for a theme, and they're trying to tell you this like these yeah. ideas of true stories within false stories within true stories. But number one, I get it. Number two, it's like, I guess I'm always disappointed when I find out, you know, like the 10th thing I look up that it was a writer's idea is just something he clipped from the head, the newspaper.
Okay. Well, I think, so a lot of the things I'm saying from a negative perspective, because that's how I feel about it. But I think it depends on how much you're willing to open yourself up to the absurdity of this season and the absurdity of particular events like the UFO.
Sure.
Whether or not you're going to see this as a negative or positive thing. And I don't think there's a wrong answer here. I think there are
this is people's opinions,
multiple answers, and they're all opinions.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
What, in your opinion, is the better season? Season one or season two?
Season one.
Okay. Would you agree with this statement? Overall, season 2 was better. Season 1, though, had a much more satisfying end stretch and maybe had a higher ceiling, but the overall average quality of Season 2 was better.
No.
See, that's where I come down.
Okay.
Like, I think Season 2 is a much more interesting, you know, the use of period piece made it, I think, visually interesting. The setup was, you know, on the surface more exciting, and it just led up to this big, you know, massacre at Sioux Falls City that ultimately kind of wheels fell off 2 episodes ago, and then we ended up with this thing kind of limping to the middle, where in the other, in Season 1, the dance between Lorne and Lester was extremely interesting.
Yeah.
We had a diversion into the land of the Supermarket King that kind of pulled the season down for me, but the last 3 mm-hmm. episodes were like fire, and that's what sticks with me.
I mean, there are a lot of things that stick with me. I mean, that snow scene from Season 1 was stylistically as interesting as anything they did in Season 2.
Uh-huh.
I liked the character of Lester, I think, more than the characters of Ed and Peggy.
Sure.
Marginally so. I mean, it wasn't like night and day. Mm-hmm. I still liked Ed and Peggy a lot, or enjoyed watching them. I don't know if I liked them.
Mm-hmm.
But Lester, there was some quality. Maybe it's just, you know, he's a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Sheen or whatever his name
Martin
is.
Freeman Sheen. Yeah.
Martin Freeman. He's a great actor, and I liked him.
Yeah, but I also think maybe the highs were not as high in Season 2 and the lows weren't as lows, because the UFO, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to say. I do think that certainly there was nothing in this season for me that compares to Martin or Lester going to the travel agency to try to get his paperwork.
Sure.
And sending his new wife into there. Like, to me, that was like heart in your throat. Fingers over your eyes, kind of TV watching, and it threatened to go there a couple times this season, but it never quite got there. And the best case, you know, we had a UFO that came in the middle. Now, there was a lot of things I think in this episode that I really, really liked. Number one,
me too.
I kind of think that the final soliloquy with Hank explaining his writing.
Uh-huh.
It didn't exactly make peace with the UFO thing for me, but this concept of mixed messages, you know, like it's, mm-hmm. it's, that's another palindromic thing. We went into, because of all the events in the season, we went into Hank's office and we all saw UFO language. Now, there's a couple of people like, well, we don't really know what it was, but I think that's, you know, everyone's first impression is, oh shit, this is some UFO research he's doing.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it turns out that, no, he's working on his universal language, which also is a true story. Some guy actually did this.
Yeah, lots of people have.
Yeah. But this, I thought that was really interesting, that we all saw the same thing but misinterpreted it.
Okay.
And, like, how true is that for this story as a whole? Because that was something I know you were kind of, like, lost patience with the search for Rye, but I thought that was interesting, is that everyone had access to the same information, but because of their biases and what they knew and what they're carrying into their decision-making process, came to different conclusions about it.
Hmm.
Which is where I thought a lot of the tension, the early tension that was really effective, worked in the first half of the season. So, like, that, I think, was a really kind of a stylistic and storytelling and narrative triumph. The fact that he was able to bring that together and end with a really, really, really good scene with Ted Danson.
Yeah, that final scene... with the family there. Well, I guess it's not the final scene, but that close to final scene with the family there is heartfelt in a way that feels honest and is a great way to cap off this season, I think.
Yeah.
Like, if you were... So, a lot of people are kind of disappointed with this finale. I'm not one of those. I think this finale was really strong. But you have to come in with a certain perspective. If you're not expecting kind of a denouement or let's stick with denouement. Let's honor Camus by sticking with denouement.
By butchering French.
Uh-huh.
Denouement.
Or an epilogue for people who don't understand what that means. If you don't come in expecting the epilogue here, you're going to be disappointed. All of the action took place last episode.
So do you think it was a mistake? Do you think it was a mistake then to open up with this pulse pounding war pigs with Lou running down the alley? Because I thought, like,
I think so.
Holy
yeah.
shit, this is going to be badass. We're going to find out where Lou got his limp. Uh-huh. We're going to, you know, it's going to be this last stand. What's going to happen to Ed and Peggy? And all that stuff just wrapped up in like 10, 15 minutes, and the rest was all, as you say, epilogue. And some of the, yeah. like, I very viscerally don't like Hanzi being.
Ugh. Tripoli
with and meeting and the origin of Numbers and Wrench.
Okay,
all that let's stuff talk, is bad news. But
let's get into some specifics there, because a lot of people might not realize this. I didn't until I read an interview. I was like, oh, there's a deaf kid. Numbers was deaf in the first season.
So everyone, I think, on first watch got the fact that this is supposed to be Wrench and Numbers. If you're a podcast listening Fargo fan.
But I did not remember that the gangster's name was Tripoli.
I did not either. But as soon as he started talking about changing your face, I'm like, I was on my phone and I'm like, oh, son of a bitch. They really, really went there.
So to be clear, we're talking about season one where the guy is eating fish, this gangster guy. And I forget exactly what the scene is, but
there, it's in Fargo. And this guy has eliminated that truck. Lester killed the trucker guy, who was this guy's, you know, low level management, you know, whatever, trucker or coordinator. Teamster guy.
And this guy's all head in a bag.
And this guy's all like, I don't give a shit. And the way he kind of delivers the lines is kind of Hanzi-esque. I mean, it's there, but damn. Like, this.
They really look absolutely nothing alike. And I. Like, 1970s reconstructive surgery is not that good, people. Come on.
Also, doesn't that really take away from Hanzi's world-weary, I'm tired of this life? Like, I thought he was talking about killing, or maybe he was just talking about being someone's, less, not as good as. Because the other thing, which I thought was highly entertaining, is the fact that Sepinwall, in his review and in the comment section, is utterly refusing to deal with the concept that Hanzi is Otto's child.
He is. Point of fact.
The point of fact.
Otto and the Native American. Maid?
Cook?
They call her a maid in this episode, but I don't know what she is. She's
the house servant,
butler of some kind. Yeah.
I mean, that's what she is. It's I don't think she gets a salary.
No, there's nothing good about that relationship.
No.
But yeah, we find out in a single line that Hanzi is kind of the love child of Otto and her.
Which really, the fact that he was sent to reservation school and the fact that he's not even mentioned as a child. I mean, I guess that Floyd doesn't. How could she not know? Does that make Floyd retroactively dumber than we think, or is she know but overlooks it?
Yeah, I'm not certain.
I don't know, but I thought that kind of was sort of interesting. But doing that and then also making him the big bad of Fargo. Well, he's not the big bad. He's the big bad that gets taken down by Lester in Fargo season one. I thought that was another one of these instances where. Everything, the Wrench and Numbers thing and the Tripoli thing and all of that was too cute. All together, it was way too cute.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. I think they did need that information about Hanzi, though, to bring a satisfying conclusion to his story.
That's, yes,
as
you're
far
right.
As him being Otto and the
you're right.
son.
I do think that this undermines the experiment with narration in last season, or last episode, because, like, seriously, no one knows that Hanzi was the love, like,
I get the feeling that some of the kids know, like Dodd and Bear might know.
Well, maybe no one did. Maybe that's a secret that he took to his fate grave.
It's possible. But I don't know. I thought that was a satisfying bit of information that recontextualizes his reasons
especially
for betraying
since
the
Hanzi's
family.
Especially since Hanzi's mom's got a free car and a bag full of money and a story to tell.
Like, yeah, that's true.
You know, there is one person who knows the truth.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe she, Hanzi got to her and says, you know, if you respect me, Ma, I've had a rough life. Maybe not make this a public thing. I don't know.
Yeah, but the reason I like it is it says a lot about why
he
gave up that life. You know, he's tired not only of the shit he gets when he walks into a bar for a glass of water, he's tired of the shit he gets from his fucking family day in and day out who won't acknowledge who he is. Don't want him to be a part of the family. Want him to be some kind of outcast servant.
Right, and how many times he was sent to fetch the sons of Otto?
Yeah.
Like, I'm a less good version. Like, I'm not even considered in any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, I wish I'd... I actually know... I feel like I understand all of Hanzi's motivation for everything he did. The only thing I don't understand is why he backed Dodd's play to begin with. Other than, I guess, if he was... Maybe this... I'm just having a podcast revelation. Maybe he hated the Gerhardt so much that he backed the wrong dog on purpose.
To bring them down.
Like, Dodd's an idiot.
Here's the opportunity.
The old woman might be able to turn these things around. Fuck them. I'm going to hand them the gasoline and the matches and the accelerant.
I can see that.
So that now I feel like every that one line of exposition, I do feel like there's got to be a cleverer way that you could have that information pass through than the dude from Buffalo, like, you know, are you that guy? I mean,
yeah, it's a... I don't know who this guy... Has this guy... This guy's seen the maid, right?
Sure.
And he's seen Otto.
Hmm.
He's not going to assume that Mike Milligan is the love child of Otto and the maid.
I
mean, he did. He did, so I'm wrong about that, well, but I mean, he's a fool.
It could have been... I don't know. I took it as maybe he could be shining him on a bit.
Okay. Like, he is playing, you know, calling that you whole scene a little.
Yeah, I'm calling you a bastard to your face, but in kind of like a plausibly deniable way.
Sure.
And I feel like that was kind of the fault. I feel like that was kind of the tone of that.
It was, yeah. That whole scene, really. But that's a great scene. That's a fantastic scene.
It was.
Mike Milligan with his...
For Mike Milligan, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times this episode.
It was. How do you feel about the way they left Mike Milligan? He goes back to Kansas City and they say, "Great job, buddy. We're promoting you. Here's your new desk with a fancy typewriter on it."
I think the most insightful thing about this episode I read on Alan Sepinwall's comment section, where a person said that my favorite lens to view this season was that this is a statement about big corporations versus individuality. And like, this is Walmart versus the mom and pop stores. You know, obviously Walmart is the Kansas City Mafia. The mom and pop stores are, you know, the Gerhardts, but also like how Main Street America affects us too. Like, Ed and Peggy are average day Americans, and they're the types that if you stop them on the street, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, we totally like Floyd's Dime and Save, and we like you know, Joe's Butcher Shop or whoever, Big Joe's Butcher Shop, and we'd never go to Walmart." But then every time Walmart opens in a small town, the people are like, "Oh, I can't beat those savings," and they slit the small-time shopkeep's throat. And that's what kind of Ed and Peggy do indirectly. And also how these big stores, you know, co-opt individuality and kind of harness them for this mediocrity, or they'll take, you know, really genuine, striking individuals and package them and sell them, like Mike Milligan, you know.
Sure.
Hey, you know, what brought you here was the cowboy suit and the fro, the kind of, you know, mid-level fro, and your personal essence. You walk in the door, bam, there's Mike Milligan. Fuck all that, put it in a closet. Here's your IBM Selectric typewriter.
A lot of good his Jabberwocky's going to do him in that office, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe he'll just sit there typing out Jabberwocky for years on end.
I don't know. Like, it might suit him good on the golf course, because in the executive golfer, there's always the guy who gets a little too liquored up and just starts spouting nonsense. He could be like, "Snicker snack when his Warble Club." And,
sure.
It'd be a hit. Mike always cracking wise.
Yeah. And it makes me wonder about Mike's fate. Like, I know... He's kind of just left up in the air. I don't think he has a clear, like, this is the future of Mike, because he's clearly going to be dissatisfied in this position.
Well, right. And like,
he's too much of a personality. He's too much of a character.
I mean, he goes into the Gerhardt's home, and say what you will about the Gerhardts, that was a home with some personality, and it's got the Weimar Republic kind of quasi-Nazi shit hanging up, and it's all dark wood paneling and intimate seating and sumptuous leather and big roaring fires and...
Strudels and
schnitzel, and then you go to what he's going to inherit. What he thought he was getting was the throne to this empire. I will now wear the crown, and what he actually gets is a corner office with a tiny, well, not a corner office, a phone book office with a little window and a typewriter.
Yeah.
And a sweat postage. If you can save us $1 million a year in postage, that's where you'll really...
And I got to imagine the truthfulness and... The tragedy of his own words are ringing in his head when he's like, the past can no more change the future than the future can change the past, right? Like, the times they are a-changing.
Well, this is like the
and
revolution.
Sorry, Mike, this is who you need to be now if you want to be a quote-unquote businessman gangster.
Right.
If you want to roll with the punches and change with the times, you have to change who you are, and I don't know that Mike is satisfied doing that. He certainly doesn't look it at the end of this.
Sure.
So I think his future is up in the air. I don't know that I picture him at the desk for much longer than about a week.
Yeah, I don't know. That's the thing. Like, or maybe he just, the sadder way to interpret that is that he eventually buckles down and says, all right, I'm going to play this money game. And the Mike Milligan, the colorful, vibrant, fast-talking, Lewis Carroll-quoting motherfucker is going to be...
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing.
Done.
Is like,
above all,
how bad does the
guy.
Fargo job have to suck for, you know, because whoever Casey Big Man is, the Arkin character.
Oh,
directed it.
Sammy Tonin.
Yeah, Sammy Tonin. However,
Theo Tonin. Sorry, Sammy's his son.
He's the idiot. However shitty he thinks that job is, and he describes it all as middle management and paper pushers, like, how bad must that job be for Mike to be the big swinging? Yeah, this is the big swinging dick office.
Yeah, that tiny little cell.
Yeah, like, what the fuck? Do they sleep on nail beds? And
yeah, the people.
Do they literally
the phone
push
calls.
Boulders upside the mountains in the Fargo regional office? Like, what the hell?
And you might be right about Mike changing his tune or kind of changing who he is to adapt, because Mike is above all a perceptive guy, right? He intuitively understands certain things about the world, and he could probably see how Adam Arkin is right about this.
Maybe he becomes a financial terrorist. I mean, like, maybe the saving and loan collapse is because Mike Milligan found a few loopholes, and then the real estate boom, and then the banking crisis. It's all Mike Milligan. He has become the world's most dangerous man.
I think it's clear that he has some soul searching to do, and I don't know what the outcome of that is necessarily going to be, which is interesting. It's an interesting place to leave Mike Milligan with a big question mark.
Yeah.
What about Betsy? Do you want to talk about Betsy yet?
I thought that the very beginning of this episode and the very end of this episode wrung some genuine emotion out of me. And
yeah.
Lou's very matter-of-fact, very tortured rendition of the story of the show's opening crawl, I thought was really good, especially when he says, out of respect for the dead, you know, the rest of the facts remain unchanged, or whatever the hell they say. And Betsy's
wife laying there.
Betsy's is lying there and kind of like a silk pillow. Is like, she in a coffin?
Yeah.
She looks like really rough, and maybe she's been embalmed. And then she takes a breath, and I'm like, oh, wow. And that's, you know, that's the other thing. Like, I thought it was an interesting choice to have both Hank and Betsy emerge unscathed, even though we know they don't make it to season one. Like, I'm glad that
Hank dies of old age or,
sure,
you know, whatever.
I would imagine.
Betsy probably eventually dies of cancer. But that's the thing about Betsy, right? She goes through this bout with cancer and with these pills, which I don't know exactly what they are, but
I've gone back, speaking of palindromes, I've gone back and forth on these pills. Like, I was convinced they were real, and I was convinced they were sugar, and now I'm kind of convinced they were real again. Although, I suppose she could be having a psychosomatic reaction to fake chemotherapy pills.
Supposedly. Or potentially, I mean. But the thing is, you know, when you talk about it in these palindrome terms, she's kind of right back to where she was at the beginning of this season, right?
Yeah.
She's once again got cancer. She can no longer take these pills. There's not much hope other than to just enjoy the time she has left. And I think if you want to bring palindrome into it, I think that's where it's most appropriate.
Yeah.
It's probably through Betsy and Lou and Hank.
Yeah.
And Molly is part of that, but not really.
And her dream of the future that kind of, like, you know, that helps make the palindrome, like, that's the D in the radar, I guess, is... It's a direct lift / ripoff of, Raising Arizona, of High's vision of the future there with a lot of similar beats. But that really worked for me.
Yeah.
Because of her vocal performance and the, you know, just watching Molly grow up with Lou by her side and then, you know, knowing what happens in season one. Like, all that stuff was really, really good.
Seeing all the season one characters together really did it for me. Yeah, I liked it. So I don't know. I did. I was like, okay, so Molly's what? Maybe 12 years old in this scene where her and Lou are playing with this little Mattel handheld football game.
Yeah.
Get her something better, man. It's like 1991, probably 1992. Super Nintendo is out.
No. If she's 6 in 79, then and when she's 12,
okay, all right, you're
84.
Right.
No, that's about state of the art for 84. Yeah, you could get a 2600. I guess she would be like
12-ish.
Although I guess Nintendo, I believe, didn't the NES come out in 89?
No, it came out in 85. Well, okay. In Japan it did. I think it came out in 86 here.
Okay, so yeah, if she's in that range, and that's another thing. It's like, I didn't get a Nintendo when it was first released. Hell no.
Actually, no, I think it came out in 85 here and earlier in Japan. Whatever.
Really? Whatever.
The point is, yeah, there are things that are better on the market. Come on, Lou.
Yeah.
This fucking come on.
Like I said, man, I don't know. I don't know.
I can just say, for handheld entertainment? NES. Yeah, no, but why go handheld? You're on the couch. You don't need handheld. Go with an NES.
I had a lot of those handheld LCD games, is all I'm saying.
Sure.
Had one of the tank where you went across and tried to get across the bridge.
An Atari had been out for a long time.
Yeah, but, you know.
Get her that, man.
Maybe that was...
You can find those at a yard sale for like $5 each. The crash had happened.
Okay, what if you're misinterpreting this? She's giving that to Lou as a present for him to get him into video games.
Because old man loves this...
He loves the football. He loves football.
He can't really handle the modern stuff, so...
Yeah, the joystick he doesn't, you know, doesn't like, but, you know, she's trying to get him in that way.
You're right. You're right. Recontextualize that scene.
What else? So I want to talk about the beginning, because we kind of glossed over that. I felt like maybe the first 15 minutes of this show should have been shoved into last episode. So then this could just literally been a wrap up, emotional, tying everything into a neat little thematic bow, because it's really weird to have that whole, you know, war pigs going. Yeah. And, but then all of the Hanzi stuff was dream Hanzi, except for the very beginning
where
Lou gets a drop on him.
Yeah. And he obviously shoots Ed. And then I think Hanzi does track them too. So my interpretation of this is, first of all, in my notes, I wrote Black Sabbath really sets the tone.
Sure.
Well, apparently
it didn't.
Not.
It did not.
It set a tone that I was deceived into thinking would be the tone for the rest of the episode.
This is why we need a universal language.
You're right. If that had been a symbol instead of music, I would have understood it.
Kenny G. If you just played Kenny G at the beginning of this,
his symbol
is
just a big saxophone with hair coming out the front. So... Going through, here's my interpretation of the Hanzi stuff. I think, obviously, Hanzi shot Ed, because Ed fucking dies.
Sure.
Hanzi, I think, tracked them to the supermarket where Lou encounters him. Hanzi goes into the supermarket.
Wrong.
Rattles the handle on the door.
Wrong.
But then hears Lou coming and takes off.
No, so Lou, I think Lou runs him off before he goes into the supermarket, because you'll notice that if you notice that those scenes are all shot in this really weird... dream camera.
From the time
he goes into the supermarket, and it's the only scenes like that that's shot. I think that this is Peggy's delusions kicking in.
Certainly at some point.
So he got ran off outside the convenience store or the supermarket, whatever, and then Lou and Ben go inside and Peggy continues to hallucinate. Because I feel like Hanzi's like, you know, fuck this. I'm going to go and get my new face and my new credentials and I'm out of here.
Actually need to kill Ed.
Once Lou, that's the second time in a couple minutes that this Lou fucker's got the drop on me. I'm out.
Lou's too good.
Are you surprised that Lou and Ben have an antagonistic relationship? And I guess it's not super antagonistic in season one, because I felt like that Ben got a modicum of Lou's respect.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you might be a shit cop, you might be a little bit, like, small-C corrupt, but there's a dangerous dude with an assault rifle, and you came running with your revolver to help me, who's called you a dick.
Yeah.
You know?
And followed him in the direction that he went, so, like...
I thought that was... But I guess, on the other hand, Lou says, kind of a dick. Like, he didn't say he's a total dick, or a major dick, or unredeemable dick. He's kind of a dick.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Ben did earn a bit of respect from Lou, a very, very small amount. And I think, that's one of the lines that seals the deal for me, is when they're able to relate in that way
with
just a single word, fubar.
So there's a little bit of, I think, misinformation on Reddit, where the guy pulls up and says, "What's the trouble, young fella?" People are saying that that was the cigarette smoking man from the X-Files. And
the guy who gets shot through the neck or whatever?
Yeah. And I did this, I found a current within the last year or two, high resolution, like 3,000 by 2,000 image of William Davis, who was the cigarette smoking man. And they look a lot alike. Like, it's the really? Packs of cigarettes that put the miles on Mr. Davis's tires. But the thing is this, the guy in the Fargo had two prominent, like, facial moles that this guy either airbrushes out of every single fucking photo he's ever had, or he just doesn't have them.
Okay.
But he, other than that, he looks exactly like the dude. And I'm like,
interesting. I didn't even notice it.
Yeah, I don't know. And I'm wondering, like, if William Davis hears this podcast, he's like, "What the fuck? You're like downloading high res pictures of me. Like, what kind of advanced stalker shit is this?" But
sure,
the surreal life of a quasi celebrity.
Yeah. The other thing with Ben
mm-hmm.
that Ben and Lou in their scene later on when he kind of gets some respect from Lou. And Ben's trying to deal with all this shit, you know? He's like, what the fuck do I do? How do I even begin to interpret this?
Sure.
And play it all out. Lou gives some of the most ridiculous advice I've ever heard, which is start from the start and work your way to the end.
Well, that's what, you know, you start from
there. It's true, but it's so obvious.
Yeah.
That it's not even advice. It's
that's
just
essentially
like,
every self-help book I've ever read on procrastination.
Sure.
Just start to begin, break it down to small tasks.
And
what'd you do?
Work.
You came to the hotel. All
as
right.
Who
and then what'd you do?
You
went
you.
And your boss said he's going to get Wranglers and t-shirts. And then, no, it's like, ah, it sounds like work. I'm going to go read it, Reddit.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
I thought that advice was particularly hilarious.
I want to talk about that Mike Milligan scene where he's in the throne room of the of Otto's. What's the deal with his stare off he had with the baby face that he eventually lost?
I want to say that's Otto. In that.
Some people said it was Simone, which that's too old timey for Simone.
Yeah.
But that would, if it was a baby picture of Simone, that would make sense. But him,
I mean, turning down that picture can be like closing the book on Otto. I don't know.
See, I took it as almost like, you know, if you're having an affair on your lover and their picture is on your nightstand, it's like kind of one of those things. Like, you either turn it away or you put it down, or you're moving on from, like, if you want to do a less shitbird kind of scenario, you're moving on after your wife or husband has died and you've got a new lover, but you still got their picture, so you take it off. That's kind of the, like, almost he felt guilty. Rather than, yeah, Otto, there's you as a baby, now you're a dead man. I don't know.
Okay. I think that's, not knowing who that is, actually,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's Floyd or Otto, or probably not, but maybe Simone,
mm-hmm.
I seriously doubt it.
Nah, there's no way.
Unless
they took her to old-time sepia-tone baby picture day.
Yeah, they took her to the 1950s
Sears.
Version of Knott's Berry Farm. I don't know. It's open to interpretation, certainly. There's no clear idea who that
okay.
is.
What did you think about Ed and Peggy's sequence of locking themselves in a meat freezer? Were you surprised Ed didn't make it out of the finale? Because I was really thinking that Ed and Peggy'd both walk.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Didn't mind it.
No.
It was a perfectly fine artistic choice.
And I think the way he went out, realizing the problems here in this relationship, like, showing a rare moment of clarity from Ed, right? Like, Ed's always kind of deluding himself and just kind of not seeing the obvious for the sake of seeing what he wants to see and seeing things how he wants them to be. I felt like Ed really had a moment here where he's like, look, Peggy, even if we get out of here, I think this is over.
You know what it reminded me of? Peggy and Abe breaking up in Mad Men. Like, after she stabbed him through the gut with the homemade spear, and he's on the way to the emergency room, he's like, you know what? I'm done. Like, Ed,
okay.
Ed had the presence of mind. Like, I've only got a couple minutes left on this earth. I just want to make sure that we are donezo. And it's your fault, and I was fine with the way things were, blah. I thought that was pretty, like, I don't think that's a correct interpretation. That's my amused, sarcastic interpretation.
Yeah, my interpretation.
He rage quit their relationship before he died.
Yeah, I think Ed realizes that it's just not going to, what he wants is not going to happen with this woman. And so he's not going to delude himself.
Yeah, like
longer.
Even if we make
he's
it
fully
out of here,
actualized even at if, this point,
even if we make it out of here, we're not making it out of here.
Yeah,
yeah. I thought that was pretty funny.
Good
or
moment.
Not funny.
No,
but that was good.
Yeah, smart and good moment for Ed.
And
I was thinking, is he gonna? Are they gonna freeze to death in this meat locker? Are they gonna like? Is
that's
Hansi,
what I thought.
Is Hansi gonna either find them and lock them from the outside? Or, like, just nobody's ever going to find him, and they're going to be too scared
yeah,
to come out.
When they kept on, when they cut the Dream Hansi, because I'd already convinced myself, well, no, I hadn't. I'm sorry. I'm making myself so smarter than what I actually was. But when when I first watched this, and I didn't know this was Dream Hansi, and I still thought it was, like, horror movie Hansi with the camera angle, and he was smoking them out, I thought that's what she thought they were doing, but I thought what was really going on is he just set in a place on fire and let him burn to death.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, man, that's kind of... That's dark.
And I'm glad they didn't go that way, because I'm like, can the inside of that freezer really be any colder than the outdoors in Minnesota? Or...
But they weren't exactly bundled up, neither. Except for the natural blubber Ed was rocking.
Sure. They had big old coats on. They didn't have gloves. They didn't have hats.
Sure.
So yeah, they might have frozen to death in there eventually, but yeah, I'm glad they didn't go that way. I thought it was better what they actually did with it.
So let's talk about Lou and Peggy in the car, because that seems like where we're going to go next.
Can we talk about her reaction to this whole freezer thing and Hansi and the movie?
Sure, if you want
and like
to.
How freaking psychotic she actually is. Like, she's clearly living in some alternate reality where movies are coming true, and she's smelling smoke that is not there. She's seeing things that are not there. I mean, clear psychotic break here, right?
Yeah.
She's seeing herself inside this Reagan movie. And I kept thinking, like, is Lou going to be the Reagan in this situation? Is he going to come and shoot the Nazi at the door?
Yeah, no, it's a shock that it was just all in her head.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't have been. Kind of like
totally
the UFO
shock,
thing.
Yeah,
it was a shock for me, but it shouldn't have been.
Uh-huh. And then, of course, Ed's dead, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Ed's dead.
Yeah.
Couldn't get that line out of my head.
Well, I was also hopeful once I realized that she was hallucinating that maybe she hallucinated Ed dead too, and he was going to be able to get...
Nope. I think he's dead.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's talk about the car scene.
So Lou, you know, has another of these true stories from Vietnam. Everything he says here is a true story. Even the incredible... a Chinook miracle family save thing. This all actually really happened, and you can look it up on Wikipedia.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about this, and it's a pretty affecting scene, but he says, you know, when Ed is talking about protecting what's his, I didn't understand it, but I do, and he says, this is a rock we push, we men. We call it our burden, but it's really our privilege. You know, we've got a listener that has a different take on the feminism angle. I thought that was an interesting choice of words. Especially then when the woman tries to kind of tell her side of the story and she's just shut down with, like, a people died. Well, so did a lot of people in Vietnam. Nobody, I didn't interrupt your fucking story with baby killer, baby killer, baby killer. You know, I mean, I know it's not that simple, but I think it's interesting that this guy talking about, especially in the guy who's been framed this entire season as largely being absent for his wife and daughter, granted during extreme circumstances. But for him to say, oh, us men are the protectors and this is our privilege in the concept of the 2015 sense of the word privilege, I thought that was kind of interesting and subversive.
I think it's more interesting to go with the Sisyphus route, right? This is him realizing that the burden is not actually a burden. He's recontextualizing it into a privilege. Like, some people may see the family as the big rock that he's got to push up the hill and that's a hell.
Mm-hmm.
Lou's choosing to see it as a privilege.
But that's the thing. Like, nobody is judging... Here, okay. So nobody's judging Lou for being a badass cop that's got an important job, and he's not there for his kids. Of course they understand. What Peggy's point was, women, especially in 1979, couldn't do that.
I'm not jumping into Peggy's point here.
Okay.
This is aside from Peggy's entire
point. But I don't
point,
think you
just
can...
what's in Lou's head.
Sure, sure. I get that. But I'm saying, like, I want to compare these two because I think they're intended to be a rebuttal to the other.
Okay.
And then Lou completely shutting Peggy down and not considering, because he's like, well, people have died, Peggy. But it's super interesting because she articulated that same argument to Hank before anyone but Rye had died. Right?
What? When? I don't know what you're
when
talking
Hank
about.
Came over to his house to guard her. I think maybe they rested. So maybe this was after the butcher shop. But this is much early. A lot less people had died. Mm-hmm. And for arguably more self-defense kind of reasons. Certainly several, you know, but Hank shut him down and said, you're a little, you know, when she's just essentially saying what the frustrations of being a woman in the 70s are, Hank said, you're a bit touched, aren't you, hun? Like, sure. There's definitely some commentary here about men and women's roles and, you know, Peggy couldn't be a badass cop in the 1979 and ignore her family, especially when one of them has cancer, and be seen as anything but a heartless bitch. Where Lou is a great American hero for doing same.
Sure, and I think, you know, a lot of that is interesting when considered in the light of season one, where Molly is kind of a badass cop, but also not taken seriously, and that's...
Well...
It shows that there has been slight progress made, but not total progress. It's not completely okay.
Yeah, but consider
cool
this.
Now.
I think that Molly is at least got a desk job. She's either a dispatcher or maybe she's not even she's not a frontline cop after she has the kid, and she's sidelined in that final episode, and Gus is the one that saves the day.
Yeah. I mean, certainly there's potential meta commentary there.
Sure.
But as far as, like, you know, Molly's role in the whole thing, I think she's instrumental in it.
Yeah.
And to ignore that, I think, is also folly. But here's an interesting thing. Like, I think it muddies the waters a little bit that Peggy is clearly psychotic.
Well, that's the other problematic thing about it. That, like, this person is articulating these...
Yeah. I view her as a tragic figure in a lot of ways. I mean, her story is one of, you know, being stuck with this guy who's kind of holding her back thanks to his own ideas of what he wants. And she's kind of trying to live up to the notion she has in her head, and maybe there are some kind of societal expectations there. Certainly there are. But she's tragic. She's trying to do all these things that are causing her to become psychotic, right?
Sure.
Like, she's got too much stress in her life because of the way she's supposed to be and the way she wants to be not lining up correctly. And so I see her as a very tragic figure.
But it is undercut with having her be crazy.
She's full-blown crazy.
I wish she hadn't been crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's the thing.
I don't think it's totally undercut, but it is a little muddy.
And I'm not crazy, like, in this sense of, like, Lester's crazy because he, you know, bludgeoned someone with a hammer. I'm talking about, like, clinically...
Seeing things, hearing things,
not criminally
things, like,
insane, like legit insane.
Thinking you're living in an alternate dimension,
no, like, grasp on reality, insane.
Exactly.
That it is. I feel like that's really weird to have a character, you know, espousing these ideas. And it's also, like, again, I go back to the problem I had with Betsy. The revelation is she doesn't feel like she deserves Lou.
Yeah.
I don't know what Noah Hawley really thinks about the situation.
Yeah, it's tough to say.
Yeah,
I have a clear idea of what I've come away with based on what he's shown me.
Yeah.
And I view Peggy certainly as a more tragic character than she is, like, just plain crazy.
Yeah.
And not to be pitied at all.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a little bit of a stretch on my part, I think.
No, and, like, that frustration of not being understood, that final scene of Peggy, where it's like, look, you don't have to agree with me, but at least it's like, you know, that's her last face that we see in these series is essentially my face when people write in and tell me, you just don't understand references to The Man Who Wasn't There and Hitchhiker's Guide. It's like, oh, you don't have to agree with me, but I do place a high premium on being understood.
Okay, yeah.
Like,
sure.
Lou's like, well, you know, a lot of people die, but I understand. I don't know what she wanted from Lou. Maybe it's just like, yeah. I honestly, as a man, I can't understand and empathize with what you're talking about. You're right. Or maybe just to shut up and listen. I don't, but it's...
Yeah,
the frustration on her is palpable.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I feel sorry for her in a certain way. I feel sorry for a lot of characters. You know, I feel sorry for Mike. I feel sorry for her. I feel sorry for Simone. I feel sorry for...
Which, by the way,
Betsy,
super dead.
I guess? Yeah, we found out Simone totally dead. Shot through the heart. Bears to blame.
Yep.
He gives Danny Boy
a bad name.
Sure. So I'm glad there were several things they did in this episode that needed to be wrapped up. Loose ends that I felt like very economically they tied up.
No,
right? The Simone thing just showing all the Gerhardts who've died.
Sure. I'm actually amazed. I liked this episode as much as I did, given what a fiasco, in my opinion, last week was.
Yeah. And then we have the good night scene, which is the final scene, which I thought was a good bookend.
Yeah, another palindrome moment, because I believe that was in the pilot as well.
I think so. I think that was how that one ended.
Which feels like it's been forever ago.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, like, you know, I guess it's been 2.5 months.
Have you been pushing this rock up this hill for so long?
Sure. What did you think of the commercial for Hail Caesar? I think this is the first time I've actually seen it. It's the new Coen Brothers film.
I didn't have commercials in mind.
Oh.
It was, DVR town.
Ah. Well, I DVR, but I saw, it's like, wait a second. This is in the middle of a Coen Brothers show, and there is George Clooney dressed up goofy.
Uh-huh.
Like, my Coen alarm went off, and I backed up, and sure enough, it's got Clooney and Tilda Swinton, and who's the Magic Mike guy?
Channing Tatum,
yeah.
What are you doing, Coen Brothers?
Man, Channing Tatum's... I like Channing Tatum.
I don't like Channing Tatum.
Why?
Because I don't think he's a good actor.
Granted.
And I don't think he's as good looking as people say he is.
Okay.
He's got a good body, and that's the only thing he's got going for him. There are plenty of other people in Hollywood with good bodies.
I feel like he's a decent...
Bring in Justin Theroux. That guy can act. And he's arguably easily more handsome.
I feel like more handsome. I feel like he's a decent guy who is very self-aware.
No, and he's a piece of shit, too.
And understands his role in the world, and if he can get work looking.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, I feel like the Coen brothers will know how to use him. You know, they're not going to put dog ears on him and put magic levitation skates on him and saddle him with Jupiter Ascending. They're going to know exactly what he needs to do in this.
Is
in
he
this
playing
role.
Opposite the Queen of the Bees?
No, he's not.
Okay,
but I'm I thought we'd have a nice discussion of that, but I'm looking forward to it. It's coming out, I think, January 8th.
Yeah, I think if you guys are interested in that, the
it's got strong first run bald movies potential. Have we talked about that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've got some first run movie ideas.
We're going to be seeing things
we're going to see.
We're going to try to get movies out on Friday that are coming out that day.
Yeah.
And it's going to be premium only, cuz that stuff costs money, but yeah, I feel like that's got strong first run bald movie potential.
Sure. Sure. Anything else you want to talk about with this episode?
I feel like there's probably a lot of things, because there's just a lot of nuance. When they start talking about Camus and Betsy blows him off as like, oh, he talks like someone without a 6-year-old girl. Yeah. I wish Russ Cole bust into bedrooms like, you're talking like a woman who hasn't seen a tweaker inject a newborn through the eye with a hot shot of heroin. And then put it in a microwave. Like, it's like, I would love for them to have a nihilism versus optimism off.
Sure.
The woman dying of cancer with the man who's seen too many horrible things.
Oh, and I mean, you know, Russ Cole's not going to like Betsy's next line.
Sure.
Where she's like, oh, do you want him to show up at the pearly gates and say it was all some French guy's joke?
Yeah.
Oh, Russ is going to go off on
and
that.
And it's like, he's like, oh, we're just, she's going to come back with, we all have our time. A lot of us, oh, time's a flat circle. And he starts carving up.
Beer cans.
Whatever they drink in the north.
I think it's Bud. I think they're drinking Bud.
Really?
Yeah.
Not Natty?
Wasn't it? I don't know. I thought I saw Bud Light cans, or Bud cans, rather.
Mm. Yeah, probably. I mean, Bud is ubiquitous. Ubiquitous.
The other kind of little piece of irony, or not irony, but coincidence I like here is the Butcher of Laverne dying in a meat locker. I thought was a nice little touch.
Yeah, and as we was watching this, Cecily had a comment on, you know, a couple episodes back when Ed was longingly looking at the Hamburger Helper.
Uh-huh.
That was a callback, because we're thinking of like, oh, was he having Grindr flashbacks? But it's also the very first meal, or when he comes home for the first episode, Peggy is cooking Hamburger Helper and mashed potatoes for him. And he's like, I think it's a dual purpose. Like, oh, those are simpler times. And, oh, yeah, I ground up a dude in the meat. That's how I got here.
How are we ever going to get back to that
well,
sort of thing?
Ed, you're not. Yeah. Ed from 2-3 episodes ago, you're not. It's going to end badly for you.
Yeah.
We got a lot of feedback.
Can I ask you how... this is just stylistic. Yeah. And maybe this is not supposed to be anything. But how did Bear get so far from Lou in the shot where they show the aliens again? Like Bear, we know that Bear was right on top of him. Lou shot him through the head, and Bear just fell over.
I don't even have a mental image of that, so like I'm a bad person to ask.
They position Bear like in the foreground, and then Lou kind of way in the background with the light still on him, so you know the alien's still there.
Uh-huh. No,
whatever.
Yeah,
I think it was just a stylistic. I don't care.
I was a little bit bugged by that blocking as well. You know? Yeah. But I remember, but I can't remember exactly. I thought that there was a shot where maybe, because didn't Lou get up and he's like staring into the light for quite a while until it just turns off. So maybe he was slowly backing towards the staircase where he eventually goes up to check on his father-in-law.
I thought the thing left before he got up.
I thought he got up and actually was like for a while, looking back and like kind of stepping, taking steps back. Like he's trying to get away to get, that's my mental image, but it could be wrong.
My mental image is he laid on the ground staring at it for a while. He definitely stared at it.
I did not come to do battle on this particular field.
Sure.
And so I yield to you.
And I don't remember it well enough to tell you.
Before we get the feedback, I want to talk about one other thing. Right. So this show got renewed, and it comes back in the spring of 2017, which some people were grousing about. But that's about a similar wait that we had for the last time. And Holly says it's going to feature in some way our modern obsession with selfie culture.
Okay.
That does not sound... And so I also have a little slight disappointment that I really was hoping that the Fargo bag of money would be a through line through that would unify all these works of Fargo fiction. And that's just gone. That's just gone now.
Sure. Give up that dream.
And now I feel like, does selfie culture sound like Fargo to you?
No, I mean, not particularly, but
I'm sure girls in North and South Dakota take selfies and post them to the whatever North and South Dakota version of Facebook they have up there.
Yeah. I mean, clearly that's something that's spread across the country.
Uh-huh.
I see it everywhere. It's not, I don't know, it doesn't strike me as particularly Fargo-y, but I don't really have an opinion one way until I know more.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they can do something interesting with it, maybe not.
Yeah, and I don't even know that I want to see more of, I do want to see more of Molly, Gus, and Hank, but I don't know that I,
from what I've heard,
one of those things where I should get it.
Yeah, from what I've heard, I don't think you're going to see more of the characters from season one.
Okay, it's just going to be a contemporary type of thing.
Yeah, like the plot might intersect in some small, interesting ways, but you're not going to see those characters
again. We find that Molly has a facial reconstruction, and she looks like John Travolta now, and she's running the Kansas City Mafia.
Uh-huh, and she's... I don't know, she... I'm thinking swordfish here.
Swordfish?
Yeah, where John Travolta disguised himself and he had
clones. I'm thinking John Lee face-off.
Okay, yeah. There was essentially a face-off in this first two seasons of Fargo.
Well, yeah. I'm a Hansi.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did that directly.
So,
there's your tie-in with Nicolas Cage. He can be pantsless, running around in his underwear with his face,
Were we trying to tie in Nicolas Cage?
That's a Raising Arizona thing.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Before we get into feedback today, we have not an ad, but a giveaway.
Oh, boy.
That we're doing.
You know, we never do this.
Yeah, it was something that we got offered by FX, and we decided, you know what? It'd be fun for the audience just to give this stuff away. So what we've got here is a Fargo survival kit. It is a Fargo branded bag, which comes with inside of it a whole bunch of stuff that you're going to need to survive if you ever get lost out in the wilderness that is the northern Midwest, especially in the wintertime. You got a bunch of stuff. You got emergency glow sticks, so the things that you crack and they last like 12 hours.
Sure, for when you hit a deer on the side of the road.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all of this is really for that occasion. Mm-hmm. The beef jerky. I mean, you could make your own jerky out of the deer.
It takes time.
But yeah, and you know, the jerky equipment is not included here. You know, you have to have your own knife. Sorry, knife doesn't
come
included.
You have your own Ronco dehydration system.
Sure. Yeah, but you also have Fargo branded bottle of water, which is kind of neat. It's got the custom Fargo label.
It's thirsty work hitting deer.
It is. You have what's a really nice Fargo FX branded fleece blanket.
Oh yeah,
like this real real big, nice warm blanket.
Sure.
Also Fargo mittens. If you're into mittens, I personally myself have never tried mittens. I don't know that I like the restrictiveness of the fingers, but they're really cool. They've got the pattern. You know the pattern that they used for this season. They got that pattern to them.
I like mittens. Especially if you're in really bone chilling cold conditions, like when I've done alpine skiing. Mittens are the way to go because you don't need manual dexterity, and you won't have any if you use gloves because your fingers will be too stiff and frozen.
Sure. Then there's the essential first aid kit. And the bag itself, like I said, is pretty nice. It's got Fargo just stamped on the side of it there. Mm-hmm. So what do you have to do to win this thing? Well, first of all, you got to go to Twitter and follow us. Secondly, you have to tweet at us one thing that you would add to the kit. So tweet that at BaldMove and use the hashtags Fargo and Fargo Survival Kit.
All one word. That's how hashtag works.
Sure.
I assume if you're on Twitter, you know that.
You can't do a hashtag with multiple words.
Yep.
So yeah, Fargo and Fargo Survival Kit. Tweet at us with one thing
at
you
Bald
would add
Move
to the kit. And we'll pick a winner out of a hat of all the people who enter, and we'll get in touch with you via Twitter.
Okay. Shall we get the feedback now?
Please.
Dan from Pittsburgh. We got two, maybe three takes on the UFO thing, and then we're going to just move on.org. Dan from Pittsburgh says, by beginning the episode of the narrator reading from an anthology, actually, this isn't a defense of the UFO proper as much as just the episode as a total. God damn. How many ways can I butcher your intro to your email, Dan? By getting this episode of the narrator reading from an anthology of true Midwestern crime stories, we immediately know that the Sioux Falls Massacre has become legend. The events and characters of the show have not only been talked about by old cops who dealt with the aftermath, like Lou in season one, but by the public at large. This means that the story has been told, retold, and thus reinterpreted through many years. The narrative framework employed in this episode completely shifts our understanding of what we've seen to this point. This hasn't been a straightforward, fact-based telling. It's been a subjective. Holly has hinted at that kind of subjectivity all season, and even in this episode, rewatch the scene where Mike talks to the Kansas City bosses and notice how the split screen is telling the same story two different ways. Heck, each episode ends with a cover song, literally a reinterpretation of an existing text. Like all urban legends, this story contains hearsay and lies and has been shaped by the culture of its era. That cultural influence is evident both in the content of Fargo's narrative, paranoia, UFO, conspiracies, and its visual style, split screens and freeze frames. By positioning a story as an urban legend, not only does Holly play homage to the Coens, who have a major fascination with storytelling, folklore, folk music, parables, etc., but he implores us to question the validity of everything we've seen. Is the UFO real? If not, what is its purpose in the story? What does it symbolize? The narrator also pays special attention to Hansi's motives. The fact that he mentions they've been debated over the years isn't lazy or ham-fisted. It's indicating that Hansi has become something of a 70s folk legend. He's a figure in the public's consciousness, and he's a subject of speculation. Like Paul Bunyan, Jesse James, or Chuck Norris, no one can untie Hansi's fact from Hansi fiction. Holly hasn't shown us Hansi's life story, but rather the origin story of his myth. Does that help you appreciate the stylistic choice of the previous episode anymore?
No. Like I said, I
found
get what
it
they were
unconvincing
going for.
Because I feel like that if you remove the narration, it's a more interesting dramatic work of visual fiction. And if you remove the UFO, I think I have no problem calling this unequivocally better than season one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I get his point. It just didn't line up with what I thought, with what I kind of expected from Fargo. And that's the core problem.
Plus,
me.
Like, I get it. Like, if this show didn't open up with literally this is a true story, but we've changed some facts to appease some people and we've kept the facts the same to appease others, like, maybe the narration would be necessary. But I just couldn't
sure.
shake the Wes Anderson feel, which was totally, tonally wrong for this episode.
But you get, I mean, you get the point that he's talking about here through the introduction of every episode being,
yes,
this is a true story,
exactly.
Which we know is clearly not 100% true.
So, you know, to me, it's reductive. It doesn't add anything. And in fact, the fact
redundant,
it distracts
yeah.
some people is a bad choice. By my lights. But again, no one's wrong here. This is all subjective
exactly.
opinion.
I can see why you'd like it.
Yes.
I just didn't.
Consider the irony of writing in to tell two dudes how much you hate the final two episodes of their podcast when all they're doing is expressing their displeasure at the final two episodes of the television show.
Sure.
I'm just consider that in a theater of the absurd kind of way before you do it. By all means, do it. Because, you know, you got to be you, but just, you know, briefly consider the irony as you're on your IBM Selectric. Jake K. from Portland says, here's the thing. They don't need Deus Ex Machina to get Lou out of the situation. He's arguing the UFO is not, in fact, Deus Ex Machina.
Oh, but...
Which implies that the situation is hopeless and that the writers wrote themselves in a corner and there was no possible way to get out. That's not the case here. The writers had 50 completely plausible ways to save Lou. Example, Bear could have simply succumbed to his wounds, proving that he's human after all. Or Lou could have reached for that gun and just barely got in the nick of time. Or Hanzi could have shot Bear because fuck that dude, and on and on. They could have had Bear die while he was running at Lou or whatever. Lou could have emptied his clip on him. The point being, it's not a cheap out when they are already a million easy ways out.
You don't think that showing the main character on the brink of death being strangled by a character who is apparently impervious to all physical problems, physical destruction, is not backed into a corner?
Well, no, I mean, that's my point. That is, he has a point that there was no shortage of ways to... In fact, that's where my mind was going.
But they chose the Deus Ex Machina. They chose it.
So is a Deus Ex Machina only a Deus Ex Machina if there was no other plausible way for them to get out?
I don't know exactly. Like, I'm not sure what the exact technical definition is.
That's the thing, like, you could argue
a lot of
things. Other
than something that swoops in to save the day against all odds.
Yeah, and the other thing is, also, I guess if it's like, these are things that have nothing to do with the main plot, or they come out of, you know, I know the UFO doesn't literally come out of nowhere, but this usage of the UFO kind of
As far as the plot, yeah, I mean, it comes
like a disinterested party just comes, and that's, I guess I was hoping, even though I really liked what they did with Hank's invented language and how that kind of subverted our expectations and gave like a nice little bookmark to the end of the show, or bookend rather, I do feel like that I really was hoping to get something to where... somehow we knew that those aliens were important to Lou or vice versa, and that's why they intervened. Because that would have taken it out of the realm of a pure Deus Ex Machina. And I'd have liked it even better.
There's no reason for them to do that.
In retrospect, if a lot of things in the series had pointed that thing out that we had just missed, that would have been my fondest hope. My backup hope was that they would somehow contextualize it. But honestly, you know, the neutral result would be they just move on and do something else that's awesome and interesting, which they did. So
I mean, that's my understanding of a Deus Ex Machina, is it's something that comes out of nowhere to save things or change things, and that's exactly what happened here. I don't think there's any defensible argument against this being a Deus Ex Machina. No matter how many other solutions there were, this is what happened.
Well, JK says...
A fucking meteorite at any moment could come out and clip Bear and kill him. Like, yes, there are a billion and one things that could happen within the realm of possibility.
Uh-huh.
None of them looked like they were able to happen in this moment.
A 50-pound mackerel could have landed on him
exactly.
At that point.
Fish tornado comes down. Fish tornado just happens to scoop him up.
A pink teddy bear missing an eyeball on fire could have landed on his head and set his beard
on
fire. Yeah,
spontaneous human combustion. Bear just turns into a... A flaming pillar.
Yeah.
Anything, but that's not what they chose to do.
So he says there's only one. So I'm going to continue his right. Even.
All right.
All that withstanding.
I don't mean to say you're dumb. I just mean to say I don't agree.
The writers had carte blanche to do whatever the hell they wanted, really. The only rule was Lou had to live. So what is a fun way, an absurd way, a way we haven't seen before, didn't expect to get Lou out? What would really add to a surreal twist? The UFO. And as an added bonus, maybe Lou is the only reliable survivor of the whole thing, so who's even going to believe him? Now Lou's the guy from Rhinoceros for the extra Fargo touch. I'm not going to get hung up on what is and is not a Deus Ex Machina, because it's essentially, like, I can envision a universe where someone uses a Deus Ex Machina, and I enjoy it, because it fits the tone, and honestly, Fargo maybe should be that show. It just didn't do it for me, and, you know, fuck me, I guess. I do like the Lou being the rhinoceros, though.
Sure. I think of anybody, he's the most rhinoceros-like.
Yeah.
As it pertains to that story.
Sure.
Called Rhinoceros.
Ryan, in season one, the lead character Molly was unceremoniously sidelined the final episode, leaving her husband Colin Hanks to save the day, killing Lorne and finding the evidence to incriminate Lester. In season two, the lead character Lou... not only saves the day himself, but gives a grandiose speech about how it is explicitly a man's job and indeed privilege to do so. The only voice of dissent is Peggy, a raving lunatic who starts to voice her complaints and is promptly shut down. There's a weird, uncomfortable thread of misogyny in both of the season finales. I thought perhaps I'd misinterpreted Holly's message at the end of season one, when he had the lead character sit on her hands during the final showdown and ultimately contribute nothing of worth at all. But here I see it was not an accident. In fact, Holly's mission statement. Do you agree with that? I mean, I find it hard. I don't know what Holly's game is, because he is giving some really great roles to women. But then at the end of the finale, it's almost like, okay, you girls, your powder puffs time's over. Halftime's done. Now get the boys on the field to get. That is. I'd like to hear him speak to that, because that I can't square a character like Molly and Peggy giving these very eloquent talks about the realities of being a woman in this world mm-hmm. with how he eventually treats these women.
I mean, maybe it's, if I'm being generous to Holly here, maybe it's commentary on exactly that, right? That this is like, this is the plight that they're suffering from. Here's society's reaction to it.
But making Peggy the lunatic?
That's a problem, yeah. I think that is a problem. Even if you understand why she may be driven to a certain amount of psychosis.
Yeah. So that was a male perspective. A female perspective, Jennifer F. wrote, in the season finale, as Lou drives Peggy home, she says, what I think many women would say are valid claims about the expectations placed on women. It's the most intelligent she sounded this season. However, it's part of the same speech where she claims to be a victim, a phrase used by all the bad people in Fargo. Yeah. And then Lou shuts her up with, people are dead, Peggy. Earlier in episode 6, Rhinoceros, when Peggy says, a woman, she doesn't have to be just a wife and a mother no more. She can be, there's nothing she can't be. Hank's immediate response is, you're a bit touched, aren't you? I strongly identify with her desire to get out of a life of quiet desperation she's in, so I never even faulted her for LifeSpring. It always bothered me that part of her character traits, or supposedly made her crazy, is her desire to get out of Minnesota. I always saw this as the same feeling of being trapped that many women felt and still feel today.
Yeah.
Then I started feeling a thing about Floyd and Simone, with so much potential to be badass, in the end they are completely ineffectual. Betsy is sharp and could probably be a skilled police officer, but she's a wife and a mother instead. The beauty of Lou's speech about men protecting their families being a privilege rather than a burden got a little lost on me as I started to see it in the context of war, using it for justification, and men quote-unquote taking over, because didn't Gus say something similar about protecting his family and a sense of responsibility? The incompetent cop Gus ends up taking out Lorne Malvo rather than Molly, Gus's clear superior. I was always disappointed because Molly and the character earned that takedown. I can't imagine any film or scenario where anyone would take away the kill from a male protagonist. If Fargo is attempting to make a statement about this, then the writing comes down squarely on the anti-feminist side. Again...
Yeah, it's tough not to agree with that.
Yeah, especially when you start thinking about in terms of Floyd and Simone, and like even Betsy got largely defanged with her speech about, you know, not deserving Lou and how she was Lou's second choice. And,
yeah,
you know, she won Lou by not being a flighty slut, I guess, is the lesson to take away from her. It's weird. It's weird.
See, when Hank says you're a bit touched, aren't you?
Yeah.
I didn't read anything to him in his commentary about like Peggy's, you know, belief that she needed to be more, could be more than what she was, or the role she was assigned in this society. I thought that was him saying, you're clearly not seeing the situation you're in, because people are out to kill you and these are the kind of things you're worried about.
Yeah, you're right.
In the moment.
Or you're not wrong.
But also, Hank is a product of the 40s. I mean, he went to war in the 40s.
No, I get
it. This guy is old. He's a different generation. Yeah, of course he's going to be sexist as shit.
Right. And, you know,
that's who people were back then.
Sure. Yeah, this is all judged on a sliding scale of, like, you know, you got to calibrate, or is this person good for the times, or is he genuinely good, or, like, you know, that kind of stuff. But,
yeah.
Again, it's...
But you're right. The narrative here kind of undercuts any speech that these women are giving and the points that they're making. I don't know. I would really love to hear Holly comment on it.
Why did Peggy have to be crazy? Like, that doesn't seem like it served a point in the story.
I feel like you kind of got to be crazy to hit somebody with your car and just drive home.
See, I thought her defense of, like, everyone knows, says they know what they're going to do until it happens.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you freeze up and, like, oh, my God, the cops, oh, my God, you know.
No, I understand, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's true. I'm not saying you can't judge a person who does that. You absolutely can't judge it. But on the other hand, you also, I don't think, and absolutely say, I would never do that. That's never something I would do.
And it doesn't make them crazy if that's what they do, I guess.
Yeah.
It just, that's their reaction. And
sure.
Even themselves, they may not understand it.
Yeah. Peggy P.
So I don't know. I guess I don't know what the point really of making her just straight up crazy is.
Nikki P. says, on another of my Fargo casts, she's two-timing us. They mentioned last week that the Coen brothers said that they have a lot of unfinished scripts because they don't know how to end movies. You can see the evidence in some of the ones they have finished, so the ending of this season was very Coen-esque because it wrapped up so oddly? Clearly, you can say that and people will, but I hope for next season they think about the balance between being Coen-esque and adequately serving your own story. It takes place in the Coen universe, but does that universe extend into the writer's room? How far does it extend into the audience? They should think about those questions. That's kind of what I was getting at with the family guyification of this show. Like,
yeah.
I'm not saying they've gone that far, but I'm saying that I don't know how many seasons where you can have multiple layers of Fargo or of Coen Brothers references in a season without it hurting the cohesiveness of the whole.
Yeah.
And I also don't know whether, like, I think Holly... And, you know, again, I this is weird because maybe this is a minority opinion, but I feel like at some point you got to decide whether you're going to stay very true and almost slavishly follow your theme and your thesis and whether you need to make some compromises to tell a good story and an entertaining story.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that, and that's the other thing, is like, even though I like this very slow kind of like unwinding, it's like, what would Breaking Bad have been like if they had the long, dark tea time of the Soul episode, which was the Granite State? What if that was the final episode of Breaking Bad? And Walt just dies in the cabin and everything else. Like, he somehow managed to free Jesse and maybe got wounded and crawled away, but then we had this slow, depressing, like, the,
yeah,
you know, I feel like that there's, you got to make allowances for people's for pace in,
sure,
a story.
Well, I don't think the pace was out of line here.
Counterpoint, War Pigs.
Yeah, I mean, that's
you redline your engine in the first 5 minutes and then idle. Like, that's, that didn't really bother me, but I could see there's a lot of emails that did.
That's part of the climax. So, like, that's that. The only problem with that is they didn't put it in last episode, right? It's not like if you're binge watching this thing and you come off last episode right into this one and you go 15 minutes in.
Yeah,
and
I guess it's true.
Like, that's not a huge problem.
But I'm not
going to
let the show off the hook because that's not the format they released in.
Yes, so. No, I'm with you there. It was strange to have that in this episode, but overall, the season as a whole, I didn't feel like it had a bad pace at all. And I felt like
agreed.
They earned these final quiet moments with all these people.
That's why I say overall, I think this season is an improvement over last season. And not saying last season was bad, but last season had that whole, again, that whole Stravos plot could have been excised from last season and nothing of value would have been lost.
But the alien thing could have too here.
That,
and they have some
other
way.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like, if you took the alien thing out, is the story stronger or weaker? If you took the Fishnado and, in fact, all of the Stravos line, is the story weaker? I mean, was the story really about Molly and Gus and Lester and Lorne?
Mm-hmm.
Or was it about the Stravos, the grocery store king, and his weird biblical hangups about... I mean, yeah, I'm glad that we got the Fargo cash bag in there.
Yeah.
And I would have thought that that's all worth it, the kit, but now we've fucked the cash bag, so who cares? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I get... I like the absurdity. I feel like there is an element of absurdity, certainly within, like, Big Lebowski. Big Lebowski is just sheer absurdity, top to bottom.
Yeah.
Of circumstance. And Fargo is a lot like that, except not as severely.
Sure.
But this is the part where I really run into problems. This is titled Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes way beyond what Fargo did as far as absurdity. But the general thesis of this season, I think, was a smart one and was well executed. other than going a little too far, in my opinion.
Okay. Liz G says, speculation. Peggy hires Carl Weathers to defend her, and he's able to get her a reduced charge for the hit and run of Rye. Peggy eventually makes her way to California, but she's unable to stay because she can't afford the cost of living out there, thus ending back in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
Another revolution. That's a good question. Everyone assumes that Peggy's going to do time in federal prison. What do they have on her?
Vehicular manslaughter, at the very least.
Do they have that on her? That's,
yeah, they can,
why?
Because they've got the car.
But Ed could have driven it. What if she just says Ed did everything? And Ed, I don't think Ed acted in any way contradicting that.
So on Reddit, there's a list of the crimes that she could potentially be charged for. I don't know if they go into like how people would know and
right.
But just the things that we've seen her do.
Like if she confesses,
there are a lot of them.
Sure. If she confesses to something like this, but I'm like, man, that's a really hard case to make.
At the very least, she's involved in conspiracy to commit murder, potentially. Right? Like
how?
Vehicular manslaughter and then the literal murdering of this guy. I think Ed would probably be charged with murder.
Uh-huh.
And she was an accomplice in all of this, right?
How?
Because she hasn't been, she's known about it the entire time. She's helped him escape the law.
I thought that was one of the privileges of being married to someone, that you don't have to testify against them or turn them in to the police.
Yeah, but Lou and Hank know that they caught her with Ed.
Doing what?
In the cabin having, well, I don't know. Because a lot of that can be placed on Hansi, I guess.
And it's just like, yeah, like, okay, so you're citizen, you're on the run and you, I mean, I get it, but like, what are they really guilty of? Kidnapping a gangster who was trying to kill them, that went to their home and tried to kill them, and trying to make a deal to get it to all go away?
Mm-hmm.
Like, good luck winning that case. Especially if across the bar is sitting Carl fucking Weathers. I don't know. It's a fun mental game, because I was like, man, what do they really have on her that you couldn't say? Like, if she ran over Rye, who's, the other thing is, I have a problem describing Rye as a victim here. You know what I'm saying? That's the first thing,
well,
when Lou said,
yeah.
Oh, you mean the victim? Oh, you mean Rye Gerhart, the guy who shot three people in cold blood?
Sure. He's certainly not innocent, but he can still be a victim.
Sure.
Of another incident.
Yeah. I guess criminal lives matter. But no, I don't know. I don't know that you can. I wonder if a prosecutor look at this whole thing and be like, you know what? No, thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. There are probably a lot of things that we are just not remembering or that are being glossed over here that point directly to Peggy being guilty.
Yeah.
Of many, many crimes here.
Do you think she gets off by reason of insanity?
That's potential.
I mean, all she got to do is say, I saw a UFO. That's right.
And if Lou testifies,
then his testimony is out the window because he's insane too. I don't know. It's a fun mental experiment to play. Like what happened to Peggy?
Okay.
Jake from Tallahassee says, wonder if your BS meter went off during Peggy's hallucination. The meat locker fills with smoke. Ed lays dead in the corner. Peggy grabs a knife from the door and readies for an attack. Psych. Hansi left 5 minutes ago and she's just crazy. I guess since they showed her talking to that imaginary man in a basement, something like this would be on the table, but that's a little bit too conveniently crazy for me. Jim, your response.
No, I thought it was well within the character as portrayed.
Same here.
Okay, good.
But Jake seems like a man whose suspension of disbelief was shattered. So
we're not ones to talk. So.
I feel you.
Yeah.
I don't agree, but I understand. Matt from Knoxville said, the reason I'm emailing you is to make sure you talk about Lou and his sciatica. We knew for certain that one thing would happen this season was something said in season one. There's a massacre at Sioux Falls with enough bodies to stack high. Lou sits on his porch and waits for his enemies while tying knots. Presumably he gets injured and has a bad hip because he has a bad hip in season one after all. But no, he survives the whole fracas unscathed, and we get the explanation of his hip with a throwaway line about sciatica. I was holding out for one more twist that would give him a limp and scare him away from law enforcement, but we didn't get it. I'm all about subverting expectations and all, but give me just a little more Lou, Hansi, Milligan action to top it off. I guess I wanted to see a little more crazy, a little bit more Malvo at the end there. I'm sad to see Ed go, but glad to see Hank survive. So his point here is that his bum in the first season, he explains that his bum hip is from getting shot in a routine traffic stop, and he quits being a policeman shortly thereafter.
Uh-huh.
In this episode, if we take Betsy's future dream as gospel, he develops to glimpse somewhere between 12-year-old tabletop football,
yeah,
Molly version, and graduating high school version.
Yep.
I guess, do you think it's cheating that he got that just from sciatica, or that he didn't get it in this? I mean, I guess...
Did they? I mean, they joke about the sciatica, yeah, right? That could just be a line of him going, I'm going to get sciatica, and then him actually getting shot.
You know, Lou, I don't think, has ever told Molly this story of the Sioux Falls massacre. And do you think that he potentially made up the traffic stop limp thing because he was, I mean...
It would almost make sense the other way around. Like, he makes up sciatica to explain, it instead of telling her...
He actually got shot, yeah.
Yeah, the real story.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was just a throwaway joke, frankly.
Yeah, but I can understand if your frustration, and that's the thing, like you see, you know Lou's got a limp, he's sprinting down his alley, and you got War Pigs playing, you could be forgiven for thinking there's going to be a Titanic showdown.
Yeah.
But, you know, for whatever reason, that didn't bother me as much as a dripping wet UFO. Let's see what else. Joe from Philly, absurdity.
You know why it didn't bother me as much? Because it's grounded more in reality. Like, you can see a guy like Hanzi saying, fuck it, I don't need to kill these people, I'm out.
Right.
I'm going to start a new life.
These dumbasses aren't worth it.
You can see it just lining up to where Lou walks in there at the time that Hanzi has disappeared. Like,
yeah.
I don't have a problem with those realistic coincidences in a thing that ostensibly is about absurdity.
Mm-hmm.
Not a problem, but the UFO is a bridge too far, man.
Yeah. In your opinion, man.
Yeah, it's just like my opinion.
Joe M. from Philly says, absurdity? Question mark. We got to see the absurdity of corporate Mike Milligan being told to learn golf, get a haircut, and a better suit. Betsy talking about the absurdity of Camus himself and the two MVPs of the season, Lou and Peggy in the squad car, where Peggy makes a very valid point that is still true in 2015, that women can't have it all, but despite the validity, the absurdity in how she dealt with it causes Lou to bring her back to earth by saying, people died, Peggy. Finally... Yet again, awesome soundtrack and score, War Pigs. If Black Sabbath's masterpiece doesn't get you pumped at the beginning of the episode, I don't know what will. It did. I got so fucking excited.
Unfortunately, it did.
My heart was on red line, and then I just put it in park.
Yep.
Put it back in the garage. But whatever. Still, again, I don't want... You know, I said this multiple times last episode. I don't think Fargo is this is a bad season of Fargo. Mm. It was a really, really, really good, really fun season that had one or two bold experiments that didn't quite work for me and that jeopardized how I feel about, you know, the season as a whole. But it's not bad. And if I chose a world between a guy like Holly chooses not to swing for the UFO fence and one where he plays it safe all the time, I'd rather him swing and miss.
Okay.
And, you know, get a lot of the other wonderfully weird things we get in Fargo than, you know, play it safe and potentially have the show just become average.
Yeah, I guess I'm with you. Just bring it back a little bit.
But, I mean, just think about it. Like, there's no way, by the time he knew whether that scene was going to work or not, it's too late to change it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, by the time that the effect, I mean, that's the last thing that probably got added, and you don't really know. Yeah, it's like, I could see, it's like, well, you know, you just got the searchlights in there. It's not working. Well, you don't have the UFO yet. And honestly, the other thing is, like, he could look at that and be like, this is exactly what I wanted to happen.
Sure. I don't know. From what I read... He's talking about like why season 3 isn't coming back until 2017 because ultimately it's like a winter show and we really like to have all of this stuff blocked out and there isn't much of winter left here for us to film it and write it and everything, so we're going to push it. And he claims that like last season they had 8 out of 10 episodes basically written, like all but stamped, finished.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine he didn't know he was going to do this alien thing.
Mm-hmm. But you don't know if it's going to work or not. And then even if it works for you, you don't know if it's going to work for 4 million people that are watching the show.
Yeah, I guess. But it wasn't a problem of direction or a problem of like the elements not coming together. It was the fundamental problem of this thing happened, which is the writers, right? The writing is the thing there, because they're...
I don't know.
They're
clearly showing
me something that was written into the script. I don't think the director on set was like, you know, it'd be great. Let's have a UFO.
No, obviously not.
But so, like, that's on the writers.
But I guess you don't know whether something's going to work or not until it's on the right written page, and it's like it could go either way. But until you see the performances and the special effects and the moment that it hits and editing and the music, I mean, there's a lot. Those things can sell a lot of bizarro concepts. I mean, think of how many things on the page of The Leftovers would probably read as ridiculous.
Yeah,
like if someone were just to tell you, this is what's going to happen in episode 8 of The Leftovers, which I'm not going to spoil for people that should watch it. But, you know, a lot of stuff would be ridiculous, but it's not. And then, of course, there's a lot of people. It's funny because there's several people on the forum that are on the anti-Leftovers bandwagon that love Fargo. And I wonder if that's like this is a personality type.
Well, Fargo is a lot sillier. Fargo is a lot more fun.
No, I'm saying, but like, there's some people in the forums that love Fargo and hate The Leftovers, and they're also, you know,
yeah,
I love Leftovers, and I hated the UFO part of Fargo. It's kind of like weird.
They're very different shows. I like equating the two is irresponsible, in my opinion.
I've also recommended Fargo a lot to former fans of Breaking Bad. I don't know if that's a good move now that I've seen this season.
Breaking Bad is much more plot.
It's a,
and
yeah,
character,
this is a much
like,
more thematic
and
fundamentally silly show too.
Yeah.
So I don't. I mean, it's got a lot of the same dark humor and action, but
and there's some ridiculous the bones, stuff in Breaking Bad, but not from a plot perspective.
No,
right?
The bones of the shows are different.
Yeah. But okay.
All right. Well, that's all I got.
All right.
And that's all we got for the season.
Yeah, I guess we've done kind of our wrap-up, right? We've talked so much about this season in this episode. I don't know that we need to do a big wrap-up cast.
Nah.
We're approaching the holiday season here, so
yep.
I think we're about to take our break.
We got our bags packed.
You guys are about to take your break. We have a ton of other stuff that we're doing, though. If you are sad that we're not going to be covering any shows for the next few weeks, we are going to be doing our end of the year award stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be talking about kind of all the shows at once.
Sure.
We've got for non-premium members, for everybody, we've got a podcast that's going to come out, you know, kind of doing the awards thing, right? Mm-hmm. Telling you the nominees, telling you where we came down, why we chose what we chose, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. If you want the big behind the scenes scoop and hear our deliberations and really know our thought process, then you can check out, you can become a premium member and check out that. It's like, we're going to have hours, mm-hmm. hours of content there.
Sure.
We're also doing a Godfather 3 podcast. Neither of us have ever seen it,
yep.
but the anniversary is coming up on the 25th and we want to cover it.
It's
as kind
Christmas
of the
Day present.
The cap on our Godfather trilogy coverage.
Yep.
What else do we have coming up? We got so much stuff. We have a surprise podcast coming up.
A Christmas present for a fan that everyone gets to enjoy. A commission podcast coming out around Christmas.
Uh-huh. The other thing we got going on is a Star Wars podcast. You
little,
know, there's
little
a little
movie, little indie flick coming out.
Yeah,
week.
You may have heard of it. The Force Awakens is some reason they're doing subtotals on these movies.
Right.
I don't know what that's all about.
Pretty pretentious.
They gave it an episode number.
All I know is if some spaceship shows up out of nowhere, I'm fucking out. I'm out. I'm walking out the theater and I'm setting it on fire.
Yeah, it's an absurdist reality that they're all living in. so we're going to be covering Star Wars The Force Awakens. We're going to watch it tomorrow night, and we're actually planning on having a podcast out the following day.
Yep, Friday, before everyone gets out of work.
Yeah, so
and that's a freebie. That's a first hit free of the Bald Move premium first run feature.
Yeah, give you a little taste.
Everybody gets it.
A little taste, and then Simone will be back for more.
And then what? We're going to drag the audience out to the pines and shoot them in the heart?
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
Fair enough. You can't be pissed. You can't be pissed because we told you it's going to happen. We've got a lot of, and we'll also be
doing our 25 days of Bald Move Christmas.
Yep.
So if
there's
you're
still
premium
a couple
member,
days
check that out.
Left for that. And we'll be talking, you know, we're right now figuring out our late winter lineup because there's a lot of stuff we want to cover and there's a lot of stuff that's already kind of getting scheduled up there. Early January, be expecting us to have our full schedule. And the best way to follow that stuff is on the forums, on forums.baldmove.com, or on Facebook at facebook.com/baldmove, or on Twitter @baldmove. You Pay attention to one of those sources. You're going to find out what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's going to be plenty of stuff. Yep. We're taking a break, but the content
and
is not.
And then also starting in January, or maybe even, you know, definitely sometime in January, we're going to be doing the first run Bald Movies. So that's going to be on select, you know, when we feel like it, but probably in Oscar season, a lot of Fridays, we're going to be having advanced reviews. So, you know, you can go out when you go see the movie on Friday night, you can have our podcast ready to go. Or you can, you know, I'd like to do like a brief 5-minute Roger Ebert type of non-spoilery review just to give people a thumbs up, thumbs down to really rip off Ebert.
And then tune out if they don't want
to. And then tune out, and then we can get to the spoiler stuff. So you can do both. You can have a pre-movie experience and a post-movie experience. I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah. And, you know, if you don't want to check any of that out, if we do cover a lot of other shows that'll be back in February, specifically like Better Call Saul and The Walking Dead and probably a bunch of others. February is a big time of year for us.
Mm-hmm.
February,
like March. I said, it's us getting our schedules together to figure out the – because there's probably 3 other shows that we could – be covering
depending on when Westworld drops, right? We might want to do that. I don't know. We'll stay tuned.
Yeah,
stay tuned on the Bald Move website and the forums and everything like that. And we'll be back next year for Fargo season 3, or not next year, sorry, winter 2017.
Yeah, or spring
2017 rather. Yeah. So I guess we'll see you in a year and a half.
Hopefully not.
If you're not interested in anything else we do.
Yeah.
Just want to hear us talk about Fargo.
I have a hard time believing that.
Me too.
But who knows?
All right. Well, thanks everybody, and we'll see you then.
All right, bye-bye.